I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Really glad to be back with you.
I'm sure our listeners realise that a commercial property is not yours until the contract of sale has been signed and the deposit paid. And, of course, settlement also needs to occur. But would you like to help remove some of the mystique and concern surrounding the lead-up to actually signing the contract?
Yeah, Ken, we can certainly do that. But you need to bear in mind that I'm talking here as a property consultant and not a lawyer. And therefore, what we're going to be covering is the commercial terms of the deal and not the, you know, comprehensive legal aspects. Now, the first thing is that you need to gain control of the process leading up to the execution of the contract. In much the same way as you do when appointing the valuer and seeking the finance, went into that in some of the earlier podcasts where traditionally the bank appoints the valuer and therefore controls the finance, whereas if you appoint the valuer, you control that process because the banks or the various finance sources know that until they get that valuation passed across to them, they don't have a deal, so it keeps them on their toes. So there are certainly deliberate steps you need to take early on in order to ensure that you obtain the final contract that you want.
Okay, then. Where do you begin?
Well, in my masterclass on negotiating, I explain that the person who sets the agenda controls the negotiation. So, in other words, if you have all the items mapped out that you want to cover in a verbal negotiation, it makes life a lot easier. You actually set the pathway forward, whereas quite often the other side has only one thing in mind, and that's the price. So the important thing is that, and I guess it becomes obvious when you've been doing it for a few years, but what I found is that the key thing is that your initial proposal needs to be in writing, contain 3 to 5 variables that you want to negotiate, and also include a detailed scope for a due diligence study. And by making your initial proposal comprehensive in this way, what you're really doing is spelling out all the items that this negotiation is going to cover. Now, as I said, most vendors really want to focus on price. But when you introduce these 3 or 4 or 5 different variables, I mean, you've got price, you've got settlement terms, you've got the amount of deposit initially you pay, and you've got the period which you require for the due diligence. So there's 4, but there may be others. It's a sale and lease back discussion on the length of the term. I mean, things will be specific to each deal, but they're the core 4 items that need to go into every proposal. And as I said, over the years, I've found that it's best to put the first proposal in writing. As I think I mentioned in earlier podcasts, you might send it by email, but the proposal ought to be a formally laid out letter addressed properly to the agent or the vendor if you're dealing directly with the vendor, but spell out all the terms so there is nothing ambiguous in it. It's very clear. It doesn't carry with it a lot of waffle. It can be done in you know, numbered points. It doesn't have to be a prose letter. It can be very much a business letter. But it makes sure that everyone understands what the agenda is.
While I think of it, Would you mind giving me a link for your negotiating masterclass to include beneath this podcast?
Sure, no problem.
Anyway, it is important that your initial proposal be in writing.
Well, yes, it is. And there are probably five or six reasons for that. And the principal one is that it demonstrates that you're serious, and it implies that you're not a first timer as far as this is concerned. Even if you are, by putting it in writing and structuring it, and with the various courses I've got, I provide pro forma layouts for these offers so that you can just copy them, fill in the blanks, and make them specific to the deal. But as I said, it just formalizes it and makes it very professional. The second one is that it clearly scopes the various items under negotiation. As I said, once you lay the agenda out, the implication is that no more other items can be added. Of course they can, but that's the implication, that you've laid out the basis for it. And as I said, I don't know why it is, but it just seems psychologically, once you do that, it scopes the bounds of what's going to be discussed. In all my time, I've never, maybe once or twice over 40 years, have I seen people introduce further items. But generally, it ring fences the whole negotiation process. Probably the third reason is that it now means that the selling agent is compelled by law to convey your proposal to the vendor because it's in writing. I mean, if you do it verbally, more often than not, if the offer seems a little low or the settlement too long or whatever, the agent may not overlook but just never get round to putting your offer up, or he might mention, oh, I've had this overture from someone, look, it's not in really great form. Once I shape it, I'll bring it to you, but I'm not going to waste your time. Once you put it in writing, they must convey it. Now, that leads on to the next point, in that the selling agent cannot possibly misunderstand or distort in any way what you're proposing. And that's why you do it in a formal letter, because not only does it present you as the professional person, but it is in a form, because it comes as an attachment to the email, that it is simply on scent. Now, there's another reason for that too, that basically agents are lazy. And that's a statement of fact rather than a criticism. And if it's structured like that, it makes it a whole lot easier for them to simply on-send it and say, I've got this offer here, give us a call with your thoughts. So it makes their job a lot easier. Rather than sending this long email that's hard to read, and it then probably requires them to interpret it, it's just not as simple for them or the vendors receiving it to progress it to the next stage. Now, the next reason for having it writing is that most vendors, as I said, initially focus on the price and the settlement terms. So therefore, the due diligence clause tends to slip under the radar. And that's important. Yeah, they might sort of focus on the length of the period, but even though there is an extensive description of what's going to happen in the due diligence clause, they're thinking, well, that's not going to happen until after we do the deal. Let's focus on the commercial terms, the price, the settlement, the deposit, the length of the due diligence. And so they respond to the agent accordingly, and therefore don't necessarily pay a lot of attention to the due diligence. Then what happens is that the subsequent exchanges may well occur by phone or email to progress the negotiation. But what I find is it's not until agreement on price is near that the vendor will start to shorten its time frame for your due diligence study. Now, the reason for that is that they focus on price, They focus on settlement. They focus on the deposit, so they get you up from a 5% initial deposit and then 5% after the due diligence to a 10% deposit. So they wind all that back progressively, and they're starting to realise, well, you're not going to pay any more money, you're not going to shorten the settlement. We've got you up to 10%. Okay, let's focus, because we're not winning that many points, or not as many as we wanted, so let's at least win on the due diligence. And I think in an earlier podcast, I said, look, we started 21 business days, generally comes back to 14 business days. I can happily live with 10. If push comes to shove, we can do 7. But it's a point, you've got to leave things in a deal for the vendor to win on. So if nothing else, they say, well, gee, I cut them back from 21 days to 10 days. That was great, because it meant that, you know, the contract wasn't conditional for a long period of time after I signed it. We're going to know in about a week whether the deal's on or off. And so they feel more comfortable about that. So when agreement on all the commercial terms of the deal have been reached, then what you do is you simply set them out again in the same written format as you did with the initial proposal. And the beauty with that is that there are no last-minute surprises, because everyone has seen the same format earlier. And the other thing is that it also acts as a clear reference point when the contracts are being prepared, because I, on behalf of my clients, will send it to our solicitor. Hopefully, again, it makes it really easy for the vendor or the agent to instruct the vendor solicitor, because they've got a deal, they simply on-send it. They don't have to sit down and give separate instructions as to how it's going to be prepared. You know, it contains the purchaser's name, all that sort of stuff. So it's really simple. And then both solicitors have the same source document, being this final proposal, which is accepted by both parties, so that, again, it removes any ambiguity or opportunity for misinterpretation as the contracts are being prepared.
Being able to carry out your due diligence after exchange of contracts is obviously important. And presumably, the purchase proposal spells this out in some detail. How do you ensure that provision makes it into the contract in the form you need?
Well, this is actually a two-step process. You see, at the foot of the final proposal, what I do is include something to the effect that this proposal is hereby accepted for and on behalf of the vendors, and I have them sign off on that particular deal. Now, some agents will sign that on behalf of the vendors. Most agents want to duck for cover and just get their vendor to sign that and scan it and send it back. But I get that copy. Now, that has a couple of real benefits, in that mentally the vendor feels committed. Now, technically it's not a deal, because there's no deposit paid and contract signed. But they mentally feel committed, and also it means that the vendor has effectively signed off on the due diligence clause that we're requesting in the contract. Now, that becomes important down the track, because and this is the second step, the lawyer on my consulting team has prepared a concise special condition which reflects what's been agreed in the final proposal. And we sort of touched on this in the earlier podcast on the due diligence study. But when he talks to the other solicitor and says, look, I'll send you across the clause on the due diligence, you know, if the solicitor on the other side balks at that, my solicitor or my client solicitor simply produces this final purchase proposal, which is encapsulates the deal done, which has been signed off by the vendor, being the other solicitor's client. So he can tender that And we can also have the agent ring the selling agent ring his client, the vendor, and say, look, your solicitor's being difficult. Please call him because, you know, this deal could fall apart. So that's the way we do it. The vendor, we get the vendor to sign off first up. So that means we definitely have the due diligence in the contract. And the beauty is that the clause that my solicitor prepares effectively mirrors in legal language what I've put there in as a commercial term of the deal that we've actually negotiated.
Fascinating. Anything further you'd like to add?
Well, probably not a lot, really. What you need to remember is that right at the outset, we said that you're not legally bound until you sign a contract and pay the deposit. And therefore, what you need to make sure is that you are submitting plenty of a written initial proposals for various properties. Some people simply say, look, we'll ring up all the agents and we'll make verbal offers. As I said, once you put it in writing, it shows you're serious. So, and half the battle is to try and understand the motivation of the vendor. And once you put it in writing, depending how they respond, that tells you what likelihood you have of progressing the deal. I mean, you're going to put in a figure below which you're prepared to accept. Now, if the vendor dismisses it and says, look, not interested, well, you know the vendor is not serious about selling or is going to be very firm on the price. Generally, the vendors will come back, and depending how much they trim off their price, it'll be a guide for you as to what your next proposal ought to be. So you just keep making those written proposals. It doesn't matter that they're sitting out there, even if they're never responded to. And as I said, until you finally sign the contract, you are not committed. Now, if one day a vendor accepts your first proposal, well, then you're laughing. But you're still not bound until you sign the actual contract. And as I said, if they accept your first proposal, you probably will think, gee, I should have offered a bit lower. But you don't want to ever think about that, because if you have done your homework and researched the market and you know from what you found that the figure you're offering is well below what the property is worth, and if they do, for whatever reason, they may be desperate, accept your proposal, well then, again, because it's in writing, there is no ambiguity, and if they're prepared to accept that, contracts can be drawn forthwith, and you have got yourself a great deal.
Once again, you've been able to give us some insights which can only be gained through years of experience. Thank you for sharing them with us.
Ken, you know, I'm always more than happy to do that.